Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 371 years ago, the French mathematician and philosopher René Descartes wrote, "I think, therefore I am." It was, in its way, a declaration of independence, a shot heard round the world, the starting point of the Enlightenment and of a titanic struggle between faith and reason. New York Times Magazine writer and author Russell Shorto has made a forensic study of Descartes' legacy, literally. He's tracked down the unusual tale of his worldly remains, his actual bones, and with them, the deep skeleton of Western thought. This hour, On Point, Faith, Reason, and the Still Hot Legacy of Descartes. Joining me now from Atlanta is Russell Shorto, New York Times Magazine contributing writer and best-selling author. His 2004 book, The Island at the Center of the World, about Dutch Manhattan, made a big splash. His new book is Descartes' Bones, a Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. Russell Shorto, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom. Very nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. So much philosophy and also a kind of detective story here. You start the book off with walking us through the Museum of Man in Paris, quite a wonderful place, up at the top with its view of the skyline of Paris and then down to its lower depths where your host there leads you to a box. Maybe you'd read a bit for us. Set it up for us, Russell.
Sure. I'll read you just briefly from the preface to the book where, as you say, I set up the search for Descartes' bones. My host produced a set of keys and opened a storage room door. Once we were inside, he unlocked a wall cabinet and pulled out a finely polished, curiously elegant wooden box whose lid was fastened with metal hasps. He unsnapped these. There was a flourish of gauzy white paper. Then he reached in and extracted the object I had come to see. It was small, smooth, surprisingly light. The color varied. In places, it had been rubbed to a pearly gloss, while other areas were deeply grimed, but mostly it had the look of old parchment. And indeed, it was an object with stories to tell, not only figuratively, but literally. More than 2 centuries ago, someone had written a lofty poem in Latin on its crown, the letters of which were now faded to a watery brown. Another inscription right across the forehead hinted darkly, and in Swedish, of a theft. Tightly scrawled signatures of 3 of the men who had owned it through the ages were faintly visible on the sides. It was the skull of René Descartes, the so-called father of modern philosophy, and one of the more consequential humans who ever lived. Dr. Menessier, my host, set it on a table before me. "Voilà le philosophe," he said dryly.
"Voilà le philosophe, here's the philosopher, the skull, the actual skull of Descartes," and you were off and running on quite a kind of, as you say, intellectual detective story. What led René Descartes to this death in 1650, in this Catholic Frenchman philosopher in Protestant Stockholm? They wouldn't, you know, because he was a Catholic in Protestant Sweden, they put him in a cemetery for unbaptized infants. You remind us, 16 years later, his bones were pulled up by the French ambassador and taken back to France. Why such a storm over Descartes and his bones over all these years?
The answer to the question of why he found himself in Sweden was he had spent... He was a great roamer. He lived in many different addresses, but he spent most of his career in the Dutch provinces because that was the place with the greatest intellectual freedom in Europe. But even there, he was being hounded ever since, as you said, he uttered his shot heard round the world. There were people who were calling him an atheist, which was, of course, the worst slur you could use on someone. And in the late 1640s, Christina, the young queen of Sweden, wanted very much to make her country, her court, rival those of other larger courts in Europe and to have poets and philosophers and artists. And so she lured Descartes northward, and he was eager he needed a break from the people who were harassing him. So he agreed to go. And what happened was he agreed to go. He didn't like the idea, though. He didn't like the cold. And he knew, I mean, he called Sweden the land of ice and bears. And he hated getting up in the morning. He hated getting up early. And once he got there, Christine, it was winter, and she wanted him to give her philosophy lessons at 5 o'clock in the morning. And so for a period of time, he trudged through the Scandinavian darkness to her palace, caught pneumonia, and died. So he was there only a couple of months.
You say he was seen by many of his contemporaries as the man who laid the intellectual foundation for the whole modern program, which grounds everything from morality to law to politics and social organization on reason and the individual perception of reason. Remind us why this simple, straightforward sentence, "I think, therefore I am," was so revolutionary.
Descartes' lifespan, 1596 to 1650, corresponds very neatly with the birth of the modern. You know, this outburst of work, of investigations of the natural world by people like Francis Bacon and William Harvey and Galileo, all of which was something of a threat to the framework of knowledge that had been built up over the previous 1,000 years, which was a blend of biblical teaching with Aristotle and other ancient writers. And this work didn't sit with that. And yet, at the same time, no one had come up with a framework for it, a new framework. Mm-hmm. Descartes, in 1637, when he published this small 58-page essay, A Discourse on the Method for Rightly Conducting the Reason, he did something that his contemporaries, his fellow thinkers and fellow scientists, saw as providing that framework. And he did it most famously with the phrase, "I think, therefore I am," which people utter a lot and maybe and maybe they think it's more complicated than it is. In fact, what he decided was, he himself was trained in this in the old method, the scholastic method. That's how, when he was at school. And he always felt uncomfortable about it. He thought it was soft, as a basis for knowledge.
So the scholastic method being received wisdom, sort of handed down to the student there.
Yeah, and blended with insights from Aristotle and others. And it was a system that functioned. I mean, it explained the world and explained a lot of things for people for a lot of time, mm-hmm. for a long period of time. But then, as I say, around this time, it started breaking down, and so people were experiencing a kind of crisis of meaning. So Descartes' revolutionary task was, he decided he would sit down and take up each item of received wisdom that he had been taught and sound it out. And if it didn't seem solid, he would set it aside. And he said up front, this is only a test, because a lot of these things were, you know, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, things like that, which could get him in trouble if he were saying this doesn't stand up. So he, one by one, he sort of set everything aside that he could, until he came to one thing that he couldn't doubt. And that was the fact that he was thinking these thoughts at that moment. There is someone thinking these thoughts, therefore that person, that mind exists. I think, therefore I am. Therefore, the human, as he said, the human mind and its good sense would be the basis for his new framework for knowledge.
And that framework, holding it in the single human mind rather than in a large structure of authority or tradition or received wisdom, revolutionary, and very much felt as revolutionary, even in his own time.
It was, and it was admired, and it was there were people who saw it as sort of, okay, now we can get going. Now we have a new basis for things. And it was also feared, and people in both the church and the monarchical governments saw this new thing, which we, of course, would call science. At the time, it was called the new philosophy, as alternately as a threat or as a potential tool or weapon that they could use. I mean, they saw it as something that could be used, that they could implement or that could be used against them.
So this was the sort of the kernel, the core framing that you see as standing behind almost all of modernity. At the same time, he had another famous insight or framework, dualism, a kind of mind-body separation. It's now at odds with almost all science today, that kept, in a funny way, a faith and reason conflict alive, or helped keep it alive over many centuries.
Yeah, first of all, dualism and mind-body separation. I mean, as soon as you start saying these things, you know, if your listeners are turning off the radio,
get dizzy, fall down.
But before they do, let me just say that these are philosophical ways of talking about a very ordinary human condition, maybe the basic human condition, which is the fact that everyone has a mind, and in our minds we exist in this seemingly eternal world of thoughts in which we can entertain thoughts of Descartes or someone else from centuries ago. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we're chained to these bodies that decay and die. And dealing with that conundrum is why we have art. It's why we have poetry. It's why we have philosophy. And so that is, in essence, this mind-body issue. Descartes, in the 17th, philosophers have always had to deal with this. In the 17th century, it suddenly became dangerous because the church had, for a long time, held sway over the whole deal, over the mental world. Someone like Descartes would have put mind and soul together, and also over the physical world.
And now, all right, these centuries later, we've got a contest of faith and reason, sometimes in our own culture, certainly sometimes between cultures. Islamic fundamentalism, described as very uncomfortable with the whole world of reason that Descartes planted all those centuries ago. Russell Shorto is with us. His new book is Descartes' Bones. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. How did it come to be, Russell Shorto, that poor old Descartes' mind and body, in a way, were so separated, that his skull's in a box in Paris and his body somewhere else entirely?
Okay, you're talking about his literal mind-body problem, or the... Okay, because there
facetious
are two things. And before the break, let me just finish that point, if I could.
Yeah.
You asked me about dualism and the mm-hmm. mind-body mm-hmm. split. And
which he took very literally.
Exactly. And apropos of what you just said, he approached this way of understanding reality by insisting that there was a hard line between the two things, between mind and body. And he did that partly as a way to protect faith because, as you were suggesting, mm-hmm. he was someone who did believe that two things could work. And as a way to deal with this overall approach to knowledge and keep both things alive, he thought that the two things had to be distinct. And because what was happening was, as more and more scientists were exploring more and more of the natural world, the physical seemed to be overwhelming the mind/soul side mm-hmm. of the noumenal side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was trying to protect faith. Now, of course, what he did and what people saw right from that moment, they saw the danger, which was that as more and more of this gets explained by physical means, the terrain of faith gets smaller and smaller, and then people very quickly start to say, well, we don't need that at all, and hence the rise of atheism as a philosophy. Now, to the literal mind-body problem that he had, Descartes' bones were dug up 16 years after he died, and they were dug up. He died in Sweden. The first generation of his followers, the first generation Cartesians based in Paris, were at the time kind of like a science cult. They were a bit like the Christians in the catacombs in ancient Rome. Mm. They had this, they were semi-persecuted. Some of them were members of the church or members of the state, but they had to at times keep it quiet that they were also Cartesians. They wanted to win legitimacy for their cause, which, of course, we would call science. So they hit on an idea to have Descartes' remains removed, brought to his home soil, and along the way, by the way, the skull was removed and other pieces were taken. But the group of them that returned, they then staged a procession through the streets of Paris, elaborate procession, exactly mirroring the features of the procession of relics of the patron saint of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had an elaborate burial. Then they held a series of banquets all over Paris to which they invited important people in the church and in the government, all with the idea of winning legitimacy for science. And, the, you know, there at the very beginning of this story of Descartes' bones, you see this this remarkable situation where you've got complete religious trappings for in order to promote what you might call secularism.
But they knew that clearly even then that this man represented such a break with the past, such a radically challenging perspective on knowledge, culture, insight, human nature.
Yeah, they did, and you know, one or two of the reviews out of my book tried to make the point that I was, you know, somehow upholding Descartes and resurrecting him and putting him on a high place. I mean, I'm interested in this, and what I'm doing is following the people who followed him and how they looked at him. But really, what I'm interested in is the story of modernity. That is the story of how we have, through the modern centuries, looked at this struggle between faith and reason and whether they can fit together. And in this, through this exotic, because I tend not to prefer sort of straight up, like here's a history of modernity, through this kind of following this twisty exotic path, it's a different way to tell the same story or to look at the same events as they recur through these centuries.
You write that Descartes, with his theory of dualism, became a kind of unlikely hero, godfather to both the left and right. Play that out for us.
In this period of time, immediately after his death, he was certainly a hero to the rising the radical secularists for a period of time, the radical Enlightenment crowd, because he was the one who, as we've been saying, represented this break.
Right on down with the left, because he the left that continues to look back to him basing everything on questioning rather than and on a distrust of authority rather than the
exactly.
opposite.
Exactly. So he's the archetypal distruster of authority. Cartesian doubt is sort of the root of that. But although you might put Jesus in that category too.
Depending where you stand, but at the same time, because he made room, kind of walled off room for the soul in his dualism, he's kind of hero to traditionalists.
By creating this wall between the two sides of reality, he put soul and also mind in this separate category. And, you know, when you get down to the 19th century and people start equating, scientists start, the beginnings of brain science, and scientists start equating mind with brain, saying, you know, the human mind is nothing but these processes of the brain. That then opens them up to these charges of materialism, of atheism, of saying there is nothing but physical processes. And then the people on the other side look to Descartes, who said, no, there is this separate world, which is eternal, which is the world of our thoughts and where our soul exists. So he has been championed by both sides.
And of course, today, as you write, the prevailing wisdom in neuroscience philosophy is that he was dead wrong with these, you know, two dissimilar substances, mind and body, the notion now that it is all the same thing. The brain is the mind. The brain, if there's a soul, the brain is the soul, produces the soul. Let's go to our listeners. A lot want to join you. Russell Shorto's new book is Descartes' Bones. Bill is calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air with Russell Shorto.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I want to point out that we can't overlook the ancient Greeks. I mean, in terms of a thought process, they started the Western world off in terms of thinking.
Socratic dialogue and all the rest, a lot of questioning right there, for sure.
Oh, God Almighty, yes. Mm-hmm. On top of that, they heavily influenced the Renaissance, to say nothing of the Enlightenment. I mean, I don't think there would have been an Enlightenment without a Renaissance. There would never have been a Renaissance without the Greeks, the rediscovering of the Greek classics. The other thing is, yes, I agree about René Descartes. Having said that, we can't forget people, for example, like Leonardo da Vinci. He was probably, for example, the only person of all the artists and engineers of his time who was not patronized, for example, by the Vatican. He was considered to be a threat in his own time. unlike people like Michelangelo and his associates. The other thing is, I think that René Descartes was like one of the leaks in the dam. And I think that some of the other thinkers of his time were also the leaks in the dam. But there's no question in my mind, at least, that the Enlightenment was definitely the flood that occurred after that dam broke.
Bill, thanks very much. Russell, how do you put him in the pantheon?
Well, I completely agree with that. The Greeks were terribly important, and Da Vinci and the Renaissance. I'll just kind of restate what I said a couple minutes ago, that my point was not, you know, I want to take Descartes and put him up, rise him up above certain other people in the pantheon of Western culture, but rather, let me put it this way. I conceived of this idea in 2003, which was not very long after September 11, 2001, mm-hmm. and everyone at that time and since that time people have seen that as an attack on Western culture, Western values. And people at that time began to say, well, what exactly is Western culture and Western values? And you had a sort of reappreciation or a reappraisal of the Enlightenment and all of these things that that many of us sort of were taught at university. And so I think that, you know, I was sitting in a library and somebody, and in a book, I came across this very odd reference to the fact that 16 years after he died, Descartes' bones were dug up and people began to take pieces of him. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was kind of weird and interesting, and it stayed in my head. And at the same time, I kept coming back to it. And as a writer or just as a person, I think when you've lived long enough, you begin to feel that to trust your instincts and to feel that if something stays with you, maybe it's not just the odd thing that it seems on the surface, but maybe there's something beneath it. So this then, to me, as I explored it more and more, was a way to talk not necessarily about Descartes, although Descartes is interesting and genuinely important, but to explore this whole sweep from the 1600s. Yes, of course, you can go back to the Greeks, but you know, really from the early 1600s when when Descartes and many others began this turn, it turned the story and really created the world that we're living in now, along with a lot of the struggles that we're living with now.
You point out that it's easy sometimes, though maybe not in the heat of those struggles, but it's easy to forget how much the product of this early cultivation of modernity we live in now, how many of the assumptions that surround us, not to mention the democracy and science and technology, sort of, if you follow them back, go back to the kind of thinking, the revolution in thinking that was underway right here, paint that picture for us. How much of the framework we live in now owes its structure to, I don't know if it's a single thinker or Descartes and those of his time, but to the perspective that he brought.
Yeah, I would use that occasion to say, no, it certainly doesn't owe itself to a single person, to Descartes or anyone else. Mm-hmm. really the reorientation on the individual, the extent to which the individual individual rights in politics, an individual approach in art, in a novel, in films, this basic way that we have of looking at ourselves and the world around us, and whether it bleeds into politics or other things. For the New York Times Magazine, I have done quite a lot of reporting on conservative Christian groups who have, for example, been activists against gay marriage and against contraception. Mm. And in doing that, when you're writing a long feature, your job is to go sit with people, live with them a bit, and get into their worldview. And quite a number of these people, when you do that and they invite you in, you feel that you're being invited into a quite different worldview, one that in a way doesn't go along with these things. And I was in Maryland, this was several years ago, with a group of anti-gay marriage activists. And one man who was a minister actually said, well, you know, he and they were kind of going through all these things like the development of the birth control pill and Darwin. And then this he finally said, well, when you think about it, it all starts with Descartes. And I just I was working on this book at the time and I thought, you know, perfect. That's going right in the book. But, you know, there are, you know, we aren't all on the same page either. And we don't all mean the same things by when we talk about what's, you know, what's most elemental and what's important. And that's the, you know, part of the struggle of this, that's part of the legacy of Descartes' bones, if you will, that that there are people in this country and of course, in other cultures that have never experienced, that have never had an enlightenment, have never experienced, gone through the whole Descartes' bones centuries. And how to sort of bridge those divides, bring these people together, is I think the problem of our time
within our culture sometimes, and clearly between cultures. Let's take a call from Mike in Warren, Rhode Island. Hi, Mike. You're on the air with Russell Shorto.
Hi, Tom. Very interesting topic. I'm just curious. The topic of Descartes instantly made me recall Eckhart Tolle and his comment that. Descartes' fundamental theory that I think, therefore I am, is flawed and is an error. That we aren't thinking beings; we are beings, and to identify with thought is a fundamental error.
I think that's
Eckhart Tolle. I don't know the reference, but what about it, Russell?
I think that's perfectly legitimate, and I think that's one of the flaws that. Come with the whole Western tradition, with the Western secular approach, that I mean, it's not all to the good. You know, if I had to sort of defend Descartes, I would say that what he was doing an experiment upon to discover a base upon which knowledge could be built. So he was really looking at sort of a new university education system. To replace the Aristotelian system. And he was a very vain man. He actually thought Descartes would come up with this system and it would be called, you know, Cartesian U or something like that.
Right.
You know, that's what he meant, you know, narrowly by I think, therefore I am, and the importance of that.
Did he have a sense of heresy himself, or was he comfortable with his own intellectual journey?
No, he was a curious figure because he was vain. He was incredibly ambitious. He was arrogant. And at the same time, he was incredibly frightened of the church. And when Galileo was censured by the Vatican, he immediately stopped the publication of a book of his that he thought would offend. And so he was always doing this dance between. Wanting to express these grandiose revolutionary ideas, and then you know, as soon as a church official would write to him, you know, suggesting that there might be a problem, then he would, you know, and this really is how his you know, partly how his philosophy of dualism, Cartesian dualism, came into being as a way to sort of say, no, you know, church, no, we're, you know, we can, you're protected, you're fine in this new system.
Do you think there's a diary somewhere where he says, no, I just had to say that in order to keep the cardinals off my back?
Actually, after the break, I can tell you something about that.
We'll come back and look at that. Russell Shorto is with us. His new book is Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason, a kind of intellectual detective story. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Russell, I was asking half facetiously before the break if Descartes had thrown in the mind-body dualism to sort of buy himself a little ease from the church. You had a thought.
Well, you asked about if he had sort of written in a secret diary somewhere which way he really
Just
how
kidding.
He really felt.
Mm,
and
right.
And philosophers have wondered about that for a long time. And the two leading Descartes philosophers in the world today disagree on that point. Richard Watson, who's the premier American Descartes scholar, thinks that, in fact, Descartes was just paying lip service to the church because you couldn't get anywhere if you were going to actually deny the church. And Jean-Robert Armogat, who's the premier French Descartes scholar, who also, by the way, happens to be a Catholic priest, thinks that, no, Descartes was indeed a devout Catholic. I happen to think that as well. I think he was a devout Catholic. But what's interesting is even there, even in the person of Descartes, you know, someone who you could argue, and I have argued, is the person most identified with the birth of the modern mind, you have this struggle. You know, he voices these thoughts, these revolutionary ideas, this new way of looking at the world. At the same time, he thinks it's not a threat to the church, but he's not sure, and he's kind of bending over backwards to try to deal with it.
Can you imagine that Descartes would have imagined centuries later that battle would still be going on?
Yeah, well, I think he probably could have because he was late in life when he wrote about these issues and the mind-body issue, for example. Mm-hmm. He wondered if it wasn't the case that our minds are the limitations of our minds are such that we can't overcome these sorts of things.
It could just be human nature. Let's take a call from Ithaca, New York, and Don. Hi, Don, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I wanted to tell you, I find the program very helpful to myself, speaking of the duality of mind and body. I am totally disabled and in a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
However, my mind is extremely active, and it's difficult to separate the two, but it can be done, and I believe Descartes was exactly right with this statement and with this reasoning. And I wanted to thank you for the program. And that's it.
Don, you've got an amazing perspective on it, but what about, you know, you've got a rough road, disabled and in pain, but we all face the end of the road. What about the separation of mind and body there? If the mind goes when the body goes, is the separation real?
I feel the separation is there, it has to be there in order to survive. If one cannot reason out existence, which is what it is, you know. You know, of course, the mind and body are entirely codependent, but the mind must be stronger than the body. But they are separate. They have to be.
Don, thank you so much for your call. Russell Shorto, there's a man who's had to deal, as humans have throughout history, you know, with a very tough physical reality, and it's led him to a strong belief that there is something apart from that tough reality.
Don's situation, his condition, brings up an excellent point, which is yet another irony associated with the whole notion of Descartes' bones. Descartes himself, I mean, we think of him as the kind of the ultimate abstract thinker. You know, even his name, like has been attached to these abstractions like Cartesian coordinates and Cartesian dualism. But during his life, he thought that his real focus of his work was on medicine and was on healing the body and freeing the body of disease. And he started with this. He was very sickly as a child, and he was told that he was going to die as a child when he was still at home. And he left and went away to school and got better. Maybe because he left home, he got better. And then from that moment, he decided that he would focus on this, and he dissected corpses and all the rest. And he was also always acutely aware of this conundrum and in his own body, you know, which so think mm-hmm. focusing on Descartes' bones and his own flesh and bones. And again, there he, you know, you can look at him as this lofty thinker, but also as sort of a stand-in for any of us who has to deal with these two realities.
You write that a huge part of his motivation in trying to bring the skeptical frame of mind in establishing what became scientific method was exactly on this point of health and life and death. He lost a daughter, an illegitimate daughter, who he was deeply in love with when she was 5 years old, and was driven by that to try and push beyond the boundaries and the sort of circumscribed into what wasn't known. He wanted that power of unencumbered thought to do that, to save lives exactly like hers, the girl he loved so much.
Exactly. And another interesting point about that, his, you know, as I said, he was an irascible, difficult person who had one known intimate relationship, and that was with, when he was staying in Amsterdam, the housekeeper of the man he was staying with, a woman named Helene Jans, he had a relationship with her, and he was enough of a nerd that he wrote down the date that they did it. Mm-hmm. And 9 months later, a daughter was born, and she became the love of his life, and she died at the age of 5, and this was then the great loss of his life. And after that period, this whole period in which he really sort of experiences love, he hits on a solution, a potential solution to the mind-body problem. And that was, his last book was called The Passions of the Soul. And in the 17th century, passions meant emotions. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to him, perhaps through all of this that he had lived through, that the emotions we experience in the body, in our physical beings, and in our mind. And so that they form somehow a bridge between these two things. And so that you might say heart is the interface between mind and body. And that then, this was kind of in his last work, he was basically saying, it's possible that our minds are structured so that we can't grasp these things, how this all fits together, but maybe this is what makes us human in our way of perceiving reality.
Let's get a call from Linda in Acton, Massachusetts. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just want to say that, refer to an earlier comment that you made, that we're still today seeing the effects of Descartes' philosophy. And my field is psychology, mm-hmm. and I would place myself in that camp of mind-body-spirit therapist. And I feel that when we separate the mind and the body, we're really ignoring a lot of the science that has come out recently about the connections between our emotions and our health, for instance. And I just think that even the way medicine is practiced today, we're still not listening to people's emotions and their mind and how this can impact their health.
Linda, thanks very much. Russell, your thought?
Yeah, well, what I was just saying, I think that relates directly to that. That in a way, in Descartes' last book, he was very prescient in foreshadowing this mind-body medicine, this new approach that really in the past couple of decades has been developing. My a couple of books ago, my second book was called Saints and Madmen, and it was about psychiatry and religion and psychologists and psychiatrists who, for example, perceive religion in a way that doesn't block it the way Freud did, but in much more organic ways, such as the way that William James perceived it, so that, for example, a patient who's suffering psychotic delusions, well, the delusions aren't necessarily garbage. You can study them in terms of what is going on in the brain, and you can understand them in you know, metaphorically and other ways. And that all relates to this kind of broader approach.
We've got a caller here from Jerusalem in Israel. Paul is calling. We may have a little delay on the line, but Paul, hello. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me. I think that it's important at this point to mention that Descartes actually died a Christian philosopher, and he developed a theory that only human beings have a soul, and that the doctrine was that animals do not have an immortal soul. And he actually died a Christian philosopher that was well-respected in the church.
Paul,
I didn't hear that being mentioned in your discussion.
Paul, thank you very much for your long-distance contribution. What about Descartes at the end of his life? And was he drawing a distinction between human and animal when it came to mind, body, soul?
He did, and I think that the point is perfectly accurate. He was, as I said before, he was, I think, genuinely devout Catholic who died a Catholic, and he died, as you said, in a Protestant country, and that was one of the complications around his burial, that the Queen Christina wanted to bury him in the church that was the resting place of the Swedish kings, but the French ambassador because Descartes was Catholic, didn't want to put him there, and so they sort of opted for other places, for another place. But yeah, he was, and this again points to, he was a Christian scientist, you might say. He was a Catholic philosopher who developed an approach to understanding the world that the Catholic Church later came to see as a threat, and he himself felt that in various ways, and that's what the first generation of Cartesians felt. And then we haven't talked about it, but the iterations of Descartes' bones through the centuries during the French Revolution, the revolutionary government wanted to put Descartes' bones in the Pantheon, which they had requisitioned and made into a kind of a secular secular temple, seeing him as a secular hero. So they then decided to look at him that way, and they debated putting him in the Pantheon for that reason. During the 19th century, Descartes' skull is the subject of a whole exploration that gets into the whole, what we were talking about earlier, the issue of whether mind and brain are one or the same, and he was sort of championed by both sides.
And but of course, divisive all these centuries later as well, championed there by our caller from Jerusalem as a Christian philosopher, criticized for the thing, same thing by, you know, Richard Dawkins, who we've had on, or Christopher Hitchens, or those today who want to push the remnants of religion out of science and scientific method to make it entirely non-dualistic, to bring it right
yeah.
down to the physical.
And yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. One important thing, point, I think, that comes from this whole survey of modern history is this notion. Let me put it in a different context. November 4th, I think one reason that people are looking forward so much to a new president is that the years of the Bush presidency have coincided with a rise of fundamentalisms, of Muslim fundamentalism, of course, 9/11, people perceiving that, and Christian fundamentalism, and then these secular atheist manifestos that basically say, look, these religious people are going to kill themselves and kill everyone, and that really belongs to the infancy of the human race, and we've learned a few things in the past couple hundred years, and we have to apply those so that you can. It's easy to set up that kind of dichotomy, and I think people are tired of that. And one thing that you see in the course of the modern centuries is that it wasn't simply a dichotomy. And here in the book, I'm relying on the historian Jonathan Israel, who says, you know, you had historically you had the sort of theological perspective, and then you had what he calls the secular Enlightenment, which argued, as Hitchens and Dawkins do, that religion is the old way. But you also had a moderate Enlightenment, which in a sense said it's part of the job of reason to incorporate the irrational, whether the irrational is art or in faith, things that are beyond the scope of reason. That's part of what reason has to do. And you can see historically concrete expressions of those two forms of the Enlightenment in the French Revolution and the American Revolution. The French Revolution was a revolution against the monarchical state, but also against the church. And churches were destroyed, priests were murdered. The American Revolution, I mean, can you imagine George Washington and his army marching up and down the East Coast destroying churches? I mean, nothing like that happened because it was assumed that religion was part of the fabric of society. And so those were really fundamentally two different approaches, two different ways of carrying on the mantle of the Enlightenment.
As I read you, Descartes' bones very likely scattered in some of that French political convulsion. Nevertheless, there you stood in Paris not so long ago, actually gazing on his skull. What were your thoughts as you stood there in the Museum of Man with Descartes' very bones of his skull before you?
Well, the ironies just go on and on that he had this literal mind-body problem of his own post-mortem. And if you follow the history and where people have said his bones have ended up, the skull is in the Museum of Man, and the great body of the bones were buried in the church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés in Paris. Now, I actually think they're not there. But even there, you have the skull in the Science Museum and the bones
in the church.
A church. So, I mean, the split just follows right down the line, you know, which and it does, I think, in our hearts and minds and in our society and in the world today as well.
Unresolved, but still inspiring in a million directions. Russell Shorto, it's really a marvelous tale, a kind of a Da Vinci Code of Descartes' life and bones. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Russell Shorto, his new book is Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Carrie Schutpeltz and Michelle Tran. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.